Good. Special thanks for Karim, who organized my talk more or less the next day after I asked for. Well, I have another personal attachment to this subject because actually this was started here almost 10 years ago with Anatoly Larkin during his last visit to this place. So it was, I guess it was April 2005. And we kind of look on the problem. He was guru in strong pinning, and we just did something there. So when I came, we discuss, and eventually it appears that one needs to do some numerics, and we were both not that good at it. So more or less we did something in five dimension where one can do some analytics. Then at the end of my state, I made a picture of the board. This was pre-smartphone era, and we left it till the fall when Anatoly planned to visit us in Zurich, but his untimely death ruined this plans as well as many others. So eventually, much later, well, we first found the students who did numerics, then he did numerics, then it appeared that actually to understand, well, numerics are actually not needed, but as often the case, to understand that you don't need to make some effort, you first have to do a lot of, and then understand that, well, you can get the results easy. So that's not the last work of us, so it's already published some years, but I guess nobody actually saw it, so I can present it. And the biggest actually thing that here we kind of, the result that we obtain is something that in dry frictions called Coulomb's law of friction, and we are not expert in friction at all, and so for our model we derive it, and then I just bump into everyone and asking, okay, do you know how it is derived in friction? And I hope that you will. So the result is so simple that either it's known for ages or it's wrong, and I really hope that you will explain me this.
Coulomb's law is just that the friction force is proportional to the load?
No. That's the friction force doesn't depend on velocity. That the sliding friction is the same as friction at rest. And this we can derive, that the force is proportional to normal load. I have no idea how one derives it, and if you can help me, that would be a great thing. Yeah. Okay.
Sorry, you're saying the static friction is the same as sliding friction?
Yep. That was called Coulomb law in reflection.
Is it right? Is it
no, it's not right.
Okay.
So it's all day wrong.
It's a little, yeah. Well, it's not quite, I think it's not quite right, but there are limits where it works, and the fact if it doesn't work in friction does not necessarily mean that it wouldn't work for forward spinning. Yeah. And we also, in our derivation, we can say that in this parameter windows, it should work, and here it should not. And we have deviation from it, so. Okay, so I don't know how much familiar all of you are about vortices and superconductors, so I make a very brief introduction. So vortices are kind of visualization of the notion of magnetic force lines. So we have magnet, and we know from school that there are some force lines which quite different to grasp, because it's vacuum, where are all these force lines? So this concept of field is not that easy to get. But for superconductors, they are, these force lines are real. So you take the same magnet, you insert normal metal, you cool it down, 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 it becomes superconductor. And then these field lines, which are everywhere in the material, they are getting squeezed and to a tiny flux tube, which have radius about 1,000 angstroms. So that's really magnetic. That's like this tube, but a little thinner, and magnetic field is inside and not outside. So that's our vortices. And these vortices are lined. They can be seen almost with naked eye. So that's magnetic decoration. You put powder on the top of your magnetic powder on the top of superconductor, and it interacts with magnetic field. And then you see that they form hexagonal lattice, and so on. Why they are important? They're important because of the following. If we want to make use of superconductivity, usually we want to make some magnets or power cables or anything, and then there is magnetic field there, which is in form of vortices. So if you have vortex and you push current through material, then this current produces Lorentz force, and this Lorentz force moves the vortex orthogonal to the current, so the velocity is, the motion of vortices is viscous, so velocity is proportional to the current, and when vortices are moving, they generate electric field, which, well, that's called Joyce relation. So electric field is proportional to velocity. As a result, we have that electric field is proportional to the current, and material has linear IV curve, so it has linear resistivity, which is a bit less than the normal state, but still it's finite, so the actually most prominent property of superconductivity as having dissipation-free current is lost. Fortunately, nothing is perfect, and in the media you may have some defects, so some voids, dislocation cluster, grain boundary. Well, usually we don't know what is microscopic origin of these defects, but sometimes we can even make artificial defects there. So these defects actually interact with vortices, and they produce so-called pinning force, and then this pinning force balances the Lorentz force. As a result, for low enough current, vortices do not move, there is no electric field, and we get dissipation-free current transport. So that's what all this vortex physics is about. And we'd like to know what is typical IV curve or force velocity curve for vortices which are pinned. And, well, if you ask me to draw the this IV curve before we did this work, I would draw something like this. And, well, that's most reasonable. Here we have flux flow, so free motion. Here we have pinning, so we match one with another in such a way. And, well, there are, actually, say, number of people in the room who worked on in this field especially here, well, including Thomas and one of our program bosses, Pierre. So there is big area what happens close to the critical force, probably started with Daniel Fisher, but maybe someone in 80s, somebody before that. So that's what one would usually guess. Quite surprisingly, even writing the biggest review on that field, and I still guess the biggest ever published in RMP, we never publish any picture like that. I don't know why. But now when we calculated, now it appears that that's the Ivy curve. So it is free motion shifted by the critical current. And that's what, in terms of pinning force, and it depends on velocity, it corresponds. So you just add viscous force, which is proportional to velocity, to a pinning force, which is independent on velocity. And this independence of velocity is called Coulomb law of dry friction.
But this is just the previous case with beta equal to 1, right? If you yes. write a power law.
Yeah, sure. No, we derive for our model that beta should be equal to 1. It doesn't contradict to general power law behavior with exponent beta, just all other beta that I saw were different from 1. Well, actually, I talked with Daniel last week, and he sent me to Pierre that in some version of mean field theory, there is also 1. Yep. I think in his original, in Daniel's original, I think it was 3.5.
But it's clear, this is at the upper critical dimension, you have no convention, and then it's beta equal to 1.
Okay, well, you should tell me whether your beta equal 1 is the same physical origin as our beta equal to 1, because we are not in the upper critical dimension. We just get it from another source.
If you get some of the other exponents too, then you can tell. Like you know, like correlation
like that. In this model, there are no. Okay, so that's kind of historical remark on friction. And I think kind of modern friction started from Leonardo da Vinci, who didn't publish it in referee journal and so was not properly cited. there was, I think, Guillaume Amonton, who rediscovered some of laws which were known to Leonardo but not published by him. And I think what Euler did was solving this problem with the brick on the ramp, and that the tangent of the critical angle is equal to the friction coefficient. So this laws of dry friction, they're called Amonton's first law, that the force is proportional to the normal load. Then second law, that the force is independent on the apparent area of contact, so you can put it like this or like this, and the friction force would be the same. And then this Coulomb's law, which I guess Coulomb's did experiment, just really dragging something and checking how friction depends on velocity. And actually, well, what we learn at school is mainly this first law, and eventually all the laws that we learn at school we understand later on more educated level, but not with this one. that I just kind of, people say that that's due to contact interaction, and the contact area is proportional to normal load, but then there was Hertz who calculated, and then it's proportional not to a normal load, but to the power 2/3, and then one say, yeah, that's kind of not real, but real where molecule signed contacts, it should be proportional. Why it should be proportional? So it's such a simple law, and if anybody has simple explanation of it, I would be really great to, very grateful. For this, we have simple explanation. So now come in vortices with disorder, and somehow since late 70s, this field was mostly brainwashed by idea of collective pinning theory, where also some of us made contribution, and you can estimate critical current, can look on the creep here, and so on and so forth. And well, this slide is actually not well, it's not for you to understand it. It's about the following, that collective creep is collective pinning is more or less dimensional estimates. So it's something similar to statistical and statistical physics, to what's called Imre Mahr. Well, although original Larkin work was before Imre Mahr. But you more or less balance this term with this term and guess what is the scaling. And there is never equal sign in the formula. There is something about this and this, so you can get parametrical dependence, but never numbers. So you can get how this critical force depends on different quantities, but whether it's here or here or here, you don't know. And in this sense, it was difficult for us. If we don't know where the critical force is, how can we look what happens close to it? There is, however, strong pinning scenario where you can get everything with the numbers. Well, strong pinning, I think, was pioneered by Labuche back in 69. Well, last week we have Eshelby in all the talk. So here it's Labuche. He, I think, originally was, I don't really know, is he still alive?
I don't know.
Yeah, but he actually worked on dislocations and made a very short and little detour to vortices and published, I don't know, how few papers and really made a huge step. So it may well be the case that the number of notions where his name is attached, which has his name in vortex physics, is actually bigger than the number of papers he published. So there is Labuche criteria, Labuche parameter, Labuche this, Labuche that, and so on. So general problem of pinning can be split in two. So one is calculate the interaction of pinning center with vortex. So if you give me the shape of, like, you say that it should be dislocation. How dislocation interacts with vortices. Okay, dislocation produces some stress. This stress influences superconducting parameter. And then one calculate really microscopically the force of individual defects. And that's one part which is relatively simple and not actually that important, because more often we don't know what are these defects to start with. So this usually one guess, assume we have pinning potential like that. Much more complicated problem is to average this random pinning force, because some defects pull it this way, another that way. If you take average of that, we'll get zero. So we should get something non-zero, how to get it, and so on. And for the case where one has, so now we're coming closer to a model, we have low density of relatively strong pinning centers. So low density means that they don't talk to each other. One pin is in this corner, another is in this corner. Elastic distortion produced by them are rather small, far away. Then the average pinning force is just equal to the density of pinning centers times the appropriate average of the pinning force from a single one. So there is no cross-talking of defects, and the critical force proportional to their density. That's approximation for low density of pinning center. Now, if pinning force is relatively weak.
The question is from which state you are starting. I mean, if you start from equilibrium, then you apply a force, then in principle, I think on sufficiently big scales, you will also always have collective pinning, because the system will adapt on all length scales and then on scales much larger than the mean distance of the pinning centers.
Yes, eventually, yes, but critical force is determined, may be dependent on strength of pinning center, may be determined not by this large length scale, but by small. So like with this, you know, wandering exponent, so at short distance you have one mechanism, at longer distance you have another, and even longer you have there, but pinning is determined by small length scales, and let's say Bragg glass physics is determined by asymptotically large scales, so there is scale separation. So I completely agree with you that eventually collective effects are important, but critical current may still be determined by the situation where collective effects are not important. Now, if pinning force is relatively weak, then energy as a function of displacement is single-valued function, and force some way is positive, some way is negative, and when we average the force, average force would be actually zero. When pinning force is strong enough, then the energy as a function of displacement becomes multivalued function. And then when you drag lattice or forces through defects, it goes like this, and jump, up, jump. And then when we calculate the average force, we should the force is gradient of potential, and we should integrate the gradient of potential. And then this part is irrelevant, which because system doesn't go through it. And then we have just integration of force from here to here, which corresponds to the energy jump, this. So and then the average force is given by the jump of energy between this metastable state. And there is criteria which distinguish when we have smooth potential and when we have jump, and this criteria is called Labuche criteria. If pinning centers are weak enough that do not obey Labuche, do not satisfy Labuche criteria, then in the strong pinning approximation, average force is zero, and then one need to do collective pinning. Well, that's actually what collective pinning was invented for by Larkin-Ovchinnikov, because it looked like for weak pinning center there is no pinning at all, and one should do something about it. But we will consider a situation where pinning centers are strong. And one can actually build up phase diagram depending on different parameter. Here there is density of pinning centers, here is effective pinning strength, so normalized to the critical stress. So here pinning centers are weak, so there is no strong pinning, it's three-dimensional collective pinning. Here they are strong at low density, and so it's strong pinning three-dimensional. If we make with the same strength more and more pinning centers we add, then actually we go to effectively one-dimensional effect where physics would be determined not by the lattice but by individual and then to collective. And what I will talk lives here where we have three-dimensional strong pinning. It will work for two-dimensional as well. It will break when I go here and here, and what's going on here, I don't know. So if we do dynamics, then actually there is no jump. We go, the jump actually spreads, and we go through all the value of pinning force, and one should just calculate dynamical solution.
Remind us what is on the axis.
That's okay. Yeah. So this was energy of vortex lattice as a function of position. So we move it through the pinning, through one pinning center. Or if you wish, we move pinning center through the lattice, and we look how energy change. And that's static situation, and that's the force. And now that's, again, the static force, so that's a force that's displacement of the vortex lattice far away from defects, of unperturbed. It's not displacement of the lattice at the position of defect, that's displacement far away. Okay, so now there are, that's the thing that we solve. So we need to solve force balance equation. This is viscous force, which is proportional to velocity. That's the external drive, external force, and that's appropriately average pinning force from many defects. And we should find velocity from this equation. To do that, we should calculate average pinning force, and this we did in this strong pinning single pin approximation. So we displace vortex lattice with some velocity, look how the lattice gets deformed. So if there were no pinning potential, displacement would be simply proportional to time, so just homogeneous motion. Now, because of pinning, it would be not, it would be some jerky motion. Now this force depends on displacement, so this is nonlinear integral equation, which stopped us with Larkin here 10 years ago. But this equation we should solve on the computer, find u, substitute this displacement here to integrate, and then we get the force as a function of velocity, plug this force back here, and solve velocity versus external force problem, and we get force velocity or current voltage curve. So that's the problem. And this equation can be easily solved on the computer if you know how to solve equation on the computer. So that's not, I guess everyone who knows Mathematica can do it. So these are numerical results for particular shape of energy profile. So that's Lorentzian energy. And one sees a few things. So if pinning force, pinning center doesn't satisfy Labuche criteria, so here, then, at zero velocity, force is zero, as it should be. And it starts to be non-zero at kappa equal one, so at the Labuche point, there is onset of zero velocity of static friction, of static pinning force. Then at large velocity, this force behaves as 1 over square root of velocity, well, in agreement with work by Larkin, Ovchinnikov, and Schmid and Hauger. And here, At low velocity, there are also corrections which are either plus or minus square root velocity. So here it goes upwards, here it goes downwards. Well, actually, that it should go upwards for relatively small weak pinning centers is rather obvious, because at non-zero velocity there is force, and for weak pinning centers static is zero, so it should go upwards. Why it changed behavior for strong pin, that's a bit tricky, but one can also understand it without really going to numerics. And this behavior close here would be important for correction to the Coulomb's law. So that's where Coulomb's law would be modified.
Looks like there is kind of like real friction that seems like it jumps at zero.
Yeah.
So there's a difference between the friction coefficient at zero.
Well, it's not friction coefficient. It's static.
Static coefficient.
It's not. In our situation, it's static force. Yeah.
I mean, the maximum force is different when it's not moving versus when it is moving. But it goes the other way, right? Because in real friction, you go up to a maximum force statically and then you drop off.
Well, here you go
there,
maximum
the
and then you go there. Right.
The top one is more like that.
Yeah. So the real friction is more like that. Yeah. Well, and you'll see to what consequence it will bring for us. Now the most important slide. So this average pinning force has typical velocity. So on this, you see here there is some velocity scale where it's changed. And this velocity scale is the property of single defect. For low density of defects, it's property of one defect. So it depends on number of parameter of elastic constant, viscosity coefficient, size of the vortex, and so on, but it does not depend on density of pinning centers. Because in this approximation, pinning centers are far away, they don't talk to each other. So this velocity, which sets the scale of friction force, is not depending on density of pinning centers. But when we take this force and put in force balance equation, we multiply average force of one defect by their density. Then we obtain that the critical force is proportional to a density of pinning centers. Now, density of pinning centers is small in this model, so critical force is also small. Now, in experiment, we are interested in what happens around this critical force. This critical force is small. Typical velocity around this critical force, even with no pinning, are also small by the same parameter. And this velocity is much smaller than the scale of velocity for which we have friction, where pinning force has velocity dependence. So as a result, we are actually almost in static, in quasi-static behavior. And that's explanation of the Coulomb law in our case. So that's schematic thing. If this pinning force would jump immediately to zero as we start to slide, then we go from critical current jump to viscous behavior. If it goes to zero at large velocity, then first we go like this, and then we jump. And what I try to argue is that in our model, this scale, this velocity scale, is much different from that. And there is parametric difference such that this thing goes far away, and we have big region of force and velocity where actually there is no dependence on the pinning or on the velocity. So that's our picture. Well, we try to compare it with experiment, and that's the old data by Kim and Kofer. That's a quite famous work. That's when they, well, I cannot say whether they verify flux law Bardeen-Stephen or Bardeen-Stephen explain their data, because it's the same year, so, and I was not yet born. So what they're famous for is that the slope is proportional to the field. So go from half a kilogauss to kilogauss to 2 kilogauss, and this slope, which is flux flow resistivity, or it should be proportional to the field. But as you see, it's just linear with a little bit of curvature. And these are actually different material where they change pinning. There is just shift here, but it's, again, linear. There are, if you want something more modern than that's work by Eva Andrei and Eli Zeldov on, I think it's niobium selenide. So that's kind of also IV, and when they extract bulk, then it's just straight to zero. And well, that's last year work in Zurich by Philip Moll and Bertram Butlock, and that's pinning tight. So then it also looks like linear with a little bit curvature. Here, now, we can derive this Coulomb law here, and actually we can see that it's not always should be there. So if we go this way or that way, then typical parameter where, which actually we use, that velocity is smaller than the typical scale, becomes of order of unities, so alpha breaks down. So we actually can say where our results should be wrong. What should be there, we don't know. Now, as was said, Coulomb's law not always there. That's how I try to summarize what is known from friction. That friction force is actually more like that. Now, what actually would be? So we should look on the correction, so if we, let's say here, of friction force to velocity. Then if pinning is weak enough, then these corrections are positive, so it's static plus square root of V. Well, why it's square root? We can just look how Green's functions and so on, so it's like square root. Now, when you plug it here, then you have force-velocity balance, that this is driving force minus static, and then minus square root of V. Then this Bardeen-Stephen viscosity is not important at small v, and one should balance the thing here, and one get close to this point, parabolic Ivy curve, so it would be curved like this, and then eventually it will go straight. And another situation is here when it goes backwards, then it's the same parabolic but with another coefficient, so then this parabola will go not that way, but that way, which means that there would be jumps in Ivy curve and hysteret. So that's two different behavior. For weak pinning center, it should go like this, and this experiment that I show kind of reminded something here. And for strong, which more appropriate to dry friction, it is like this, and it should be hysteresis and jump. We would be delighted to say that all these experiments where it was curvature, that's what our prediction. Unfortunately, we should be a bit more honest with ourselves, and that's something that Thomas mentioned. If we come close to this parabolic correction, here, they are visible when we are really close to critical force, and in the region where the difference from critical force is proportional to the density of spinning center square. So that's our parameter. And when we are so close to it, we are actually not sure whether correlation effects are not important. Because if you just we have our theory, we have JC, which is C1N and P plus corrections. And this correction at least have NP square, because two defects can be close to each other. The probability of collision is quadratic in density. And then there would be like this corrections. So these corrections become as important as when we are. So formally, if we are really very close to this point, then behavior may change and correlation effect would be important. But in our model, so this linear is very robust. So when we make density, when we zoom in here, then some other effects may become important, and then we don't really know what would it be. But the biggest kind of effect that this is straight linear is robust in this sense. Okay, that's all. Thank you for your time.
So the exponent, so you said you got beta equals 1, coming back to the earlier discussion.
Yeah.
Were there any other exponents you had, or was that the only exponent you had?
Well, you see, we, in our framework, somehow these exponents do not appear as, you know, in RG sense or something. Kind of that's, you know, let's say microscopic model. Like, you take original mean field by Curie and Weiss, well, by Weiss, and you just do some approximation, then calculate, and you have that magnetization is equal to tangent of magnetization. That's the result. Then you can solve and expand, and then if you know about exponents, you would get some exponents. But you have this result. So here also, you just calculate and you get this IV. Now, kind of conceptually, we have just a single defect. So all other exponents of some length scale and so on, they are not there because we just have a single defect. So we need to look on other properties, what happens at very large distance when, and then we may get some exponents, because eventually we believe that long distance behavior should not change whether defects are weak or strong. But in our situation, this IV curve is determined by short distance behavior where all these exponents are irrelevant because they are coming from large distance, and what we are looking at coming from a short distance.
If not, let's thank him again for nice talk. And then,